Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
The moral genius of storytelling is that each teller and listener enters the space of the story for the other. I really like that because storytelling and telling illness narratives has to do with forming a relationship with a person who is the listener. And the process of storytelling is valuable for both parties, not just the listener who's gaining the wisdom of the storyteller's illness experience, but the storyteller gets to craft their own story. There's an oral historian I really like. He talks about how oral stories rescue the teller from oblivion. They capture a part of us after we're gone. That story will still be remembered and maybe even retold by other people. So storytelling is important.
Hello, this is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Thanks so much for the opportunity to spend time with you today. The voice you just heard was Eric Stein. He is a professor at the Evergreen State College out in Olympia, Washington, where he is teaching medical anthropology and history. Eric shares with us about illness narratives and the different types, why storytelling is important, and quite frankly, gives us a little hope as new physicians come into practice. We spent a few minutes in the beginning talking about Evergreen State College. It is very unique. He talks about how he teaches classes or how the classes are set up and kind of what that looks like. And it is an amazing place. My gosh, I think if I would have known that place existed before I went to school, it would have been a fascinating experience. So if you're looking at going to college or you have somebody that is, take a listen to this, man. It is really interesting. It's wonderful to see places doing education a little differently and trying to actually work with us and our brains and how we actually learn best instead of our sort of antiquated system that we have going on. So yay, Evergreen State College. I realize that is not what the podcast is about, but I am always so excited when good things are happening in the educational system that I just have to give a solid shout out. And it's a public college too, which is also very exciting. I just want to take a moment before we dive in and thank you so much for listening. And for those of you who are new to the podcast, please do check out the rest of the podcast topics and guests at wellnessrenpodcast.com. Wellness Renaissance is a weekly podcast that shares a really quite large array of different types of wellness topics that might be practitioners or modalities, or in this case, kind of a anthropological, philosophical aspect. And I suppose you could say ethical too, aspect of our health and wellness, which are hugely, I don't even know if that's a word, hugely important aspects of our integrated mind, body, spirit, the whole picture kind of thing. If you like the work that I'm doing with Wellness Renaissance, please, first of all, share the podcast, be it the podcast in general or any particular episode, with somebody who you think might be interested or find value in the topic. When you're on the website, please sign up for the email list. We shoot out an email each week that lets you know what podcast is out and about and gets you a link right to it to make it super easy. You can subscribe on iTunes if you're an iTunes user. Please feel free to leave a review. We would love it. Tell other people what you think about the podcast. That would be fantastic on iTunes. You can also find me on Facebook. You could certainly leave a review there as well. And if you would like to support the podcast, please consider doing so by, when you hit the website, go to the Patreon page, the Wellness Renaissance Patreon page. You'll see on the left side of the Wellness Renaissance podcast page, click Become a Patron, and you can support the podcast for as little as $1 a month. I honestly cannot put into words how much I value that support. Not only does it do the work of help pay the bills and continue building the podcast so we can keep doing this forever, but it's also that emotional support that comes with it that lets me know that you're out there, you're paying attention, and you get the work that I'm doing. So thank you so much to everybody who is part of the Patreon community, as well as the folks who are sharing the podcast as well. I really do appreciate that. So thank you. Let's head on into the conversation with Eric. I had a really great time talking to him about the subject and getting to know him and his work a little bit more. So I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
First of all, welcome, Eric. Thank you so much for your time and joining me on the podcast. This is great.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, for sure. Let me have you introduce yourself and what you do and where you're teaching right now. And where you're teaching is actually quite fascinating to me. So dive in with your introduction.
Sure. So I'm Eric Stein. I teach anthropology and history at the Evergreen State College, and I've taught there since 2007. I did my PhD at the University of Michigan, and the focus of my work is on medical anthropology and medical history. So as part of the research that I did, I spent time in Indonesia looking especially at the history of sanitation and public health. And I spent time in the Netherlands also because Indonesia was a former Dutch colony. So that's somewhat in my past. For the last 10 or 12 years, I've been mostly a teacher at the Evergreen State College. And one of the things I focus on is illness narratives. And so I'm excited to have a chance today to share some of that work with you.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into that, I want to have you kind of define what an illness narrative is. But when you and I had a conversation earlier, you were talking about just the unique teaching kind of format that you, the concentration you guys have at your school. Talk about that a little bit, just because I think that is just so, it sounds so delightful.
Yeah. Well, the Evergreen State College is a public liberal arts college. So that means it's more affordable, I'll say, than some other liberal arts colleges. And it, you know, its mission is really to ground students in this immersive experience through full-time programs. So instead of taking a bunch of different classes, students will just take one program. And that program might have two or three faculty members, each teaching in different disciplines. So the only class they go to is that class, and it will sometimes meet 16 hours a week. So students really get to know the faculty, they really get to know the other students, and they get to be immersed in the studies around a particular theme. So I'm teaching a program called Culture, Self, and Healing right now with a sociologist who also does work in positive psychology. And she's really interested in happiness and wellness and resilience. So we're tying together a bunch of interdisciplinary ideas around health, the body, and wellness for a two-quarter program. And most students are only taking this program. The college has maybe 70 or 80 programs like this happening any particular quarter where students do this immersive study. And it's been an amazing model.
I think from a student's perspective, I think it sounds so brilliant. First of all, you know, you get the different perspectives of that thing and whatever the topic is. And what a huge value that is when you go into the world and you need to see all different perspectives. You already have some kind of experience and understanding and tools to have your mind open to what that might look like, which I think is just brilliant. And the being able to immerse yourself. I mean, I know when I was in school, which wasn't that long ago, you know, taking all these different classes, you're having this massive shift of mind all the time, and you're leaving so much behind. I mean, I think of when I was trying to prioritize my work, it's like you prioritize the class or work or what's the most important, and you kind of have to sacrifice learning the other things or immersing yourself into those things because you have to focus on this thing that maybe is closer to your major or it's a harder class or whatever. And then I think of how we talk about management in our time and our focus in the world. And we tell people, oh, you're focusing on too many things. It's like, well, we've been trained for that our entire lives with the American school system to focus on, you know, sometimes if you've got five to seven classes in a day or a quarter or whatever, which isn't so, I guess seven is probably big in college, but you've been trained to do that all your life. So this idea of just being able to just drill in and just open your mind is so beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique model of teaching. And And there are a few other schools who have adapted the Evergreen State College model and taken it in different directions to create this kind of immersive experience. We're not exactly the first, but we are, I think, the school that it has a real commitment to this sort of teaching. It's great in that students can do a lot of independent studies also and pursue what they're interested in. They have to find a faculty to sponsor it, though, can sometimes be challenging because sometimes students want to do something that's not in a faculty member's expertise. You know, we can't supervise somebody who wants to do glass blowing if nobody at the college does glass blowing, but there are students who will want to do something like that. But one of the reasons I really like the model is because students do a lot of collaboration to do major projects with each other. And I think that that's an important skill that they might not be getting in other places, these immersive collaborative projects, a lot of field studies, because they're just in one program, it's easier to just go away for several days with a whole program to do some immersive field studies. And we build these learning communities where students' voices matter, their knowledge that they bring into the classroom really matters and shapes how we approach any particular subject. So for me, it's been an amazing place to teach. It's been continually creative and challenging. I never teach the same thing over and over again. It's always new teaching partners too. Mm. It's a really dynamic place to be a member of the faculty.
Wow. Yeah. How cool is that? Because you're kind of then, I would imagine, you know, continually learning and bringing different perspectives together in your own work with the people you're surrounding yourself with.
Yeah, that's right. I love to sit in on my colleagues' lectures and their teaching, and I always am continually learning from disciplines that I never would have had a chance to study before.
That just sounds so delightful.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into illness narratives. Let's define that and then, yeah, and then go forward.
Well, illness narratives are stories that people tell about their illnesses, and these stories become especially important when there's an illness that becomes chronic, that it's not something that just goes away, but it's something that somebody struggles with over the long term. And so I think I'll probably end up defining it more as I talk about the work of Arthur Frank and the Wounded Storyteller. This is the book that I use when I teach illness narratives to students. The term illness narrative is from especially the work of Arthur Kleinman, who's a medical anthropologist, and then Rita Charron, who teaches at the Columbia Medical School, also adapts this narrative medicine kind of model. And there's been a recognition in physician training programs that it's really important to teach physicians to listen to their patients' stories and get a sense of what people are going through, how they're defining their own experience, where their suffering actually lies, because it might not be in the physical ailment that the physician can see on the body. It might be something else that's psychological or spiritual. And so giving space to tell the illness narrative is another way of diagnosing human beings as complex and as existing beyond the physical ailments that they suffer through.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think about that in, it's nice to hear that there's some openness to physicians learning this. I don't know how that works with our sort of model right now where everybody gets, you know, their 7 minutes where there isn't time to tell that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're not entirely there yet, but I know that there are some younger physicians who are being trained to understand and think about stories, and they're creating practices where they have more time and more space and fewer patients, where they spend more time with fewer patients. And I did a lot of hunting for my physician, and I tried to find somebody who would really listen. And it's challenging to see this person because he takes so much time with each patient, but I think it's really worth it.
Yeah, that makes, I think of the people that I know who do have that time you know, mm-hmm. and they're more of the non-traditional or the quote-unquote alternative or the holistic doctors, mm-hmm. Whether they're a naturopath or a chiropractor or who really do sit down with their patients or practice members and really, really listen to them, because a lot of times it seems to me, and I know working with people on a coaching level, and I know when I was taking a counseling class, you know, this is what we talked about, is about those things that are beyond the physical. The physical is important, mm-hmm. but how does that play out in your life? And helping a person and really talking to them about it is listening to how they talk about it and how they frame it. And, you know, what do they actually really need help with? How much of it is being heard and how much of it is having help with solutions? But you can't get there if you're only looking at the symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is why a lot of people are turning to naturopaths and other kinds of non-traditional medical providers who do have more time to listen, because they're feeling more healed, I think, through the process of being listened to in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think that's true. And I think a lot of the things that, you know, the help that the people need, unfortunately, is outside of the typical insurance system. But I think at some point, if we're going to consider healthcare actual care, we're going to have to add that stuff back mm-hmm. in. And I'm glad to see doctors kind of trying to push for that. And some clinics are trying to push for that too, and say, this is about, if we're here to do no harm and heal the patient, mm-hmm. we need to do these things.
Mm-hmm. So let me tell you a little bit more about the work on illness narratives. It's something that I started to do, especially in the last 3 years or so with students. I started doing it when I was teaching with a documentary filmmaker, Ann Fischel, who teaches at the Evergreen State College and does a lot of work in the area of environmental justice. And she introduced me to the book, The Wounded Storyteller by Arthur Frank. And the book is powerful, it's complicated, it's challenging, it's kind of postmodern. It was written in the 1990s. It's very theory-oriented, but there's a lot of wisdom in the book, and students got a lot out of it. And I think students who had been suffering through illnesses of various sorts were empowered to tell their stories in new ways after reading the book. I'm selling you the book.
You are. It's very interesting. I am curious and interested because I think what you're talking about, what people are gaining from the opportunity to do and to read, is huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the projects that I do with the students, just a little bit. So we read the book. We talk about it. We go through, it provides these different narrative frames, and I'll talk about what those are, that help students interpret the stories that they're hearing. And they learn to do interviews. They learn to use audio field recorders. They learn to use audio editing software. And then they find somebody to interview. And it's usually, we want it to be a family member, somebody who's close to them, somebody who feels comfortable enough to tell their story. And we have a pretty rigorous consent process, so the person's really sure that they want to do this. Mm. And we try to stay away from illness experiences that might be stigmatizing. So we don't do mental illness, other states that might be stigmatizing. So people talk about chronic pain, chronic back pain, various kinds of cancers, other injuries that they've had a hard time recovering from, or other chronic conditions, diabetes, things like that. And the students go and they do an extensive interview with them. It could be an hour long. It could be a couple hours long. And then they transcribe this whole interview. And then this is where they realize that this work isn't as fun as they thought it was going to be. Because it takes a really long time to transcribe an hour long interview. When they have the transcript, they can figure out how to put a story together. And they end up taking this hour to 2 hour long interview, and they compress it down into just 5 to 10 minutes in most programs that I teach. And this enables us at the end of the quarter to listen to all the podcasts as instead of end of quarter presentations where, you know, students are all nervous and they get up in front of the room and they're doing their PowerPoints, they play their podcasts. And it's really great to hear the voices of these people that we don't know, that that they're close with, telling their stories about their illness experiences. And these are always really powerful. And so I'm going to keep doing it, I've decided. And I've done this, and I've done other life history assignments probably 10 times already. I'm not sure. I've lost count. But it's always a great experience. So that's the work that we do. And this book, The Wounded Storyteller, is the basis for the work. The Wounded Storyteller talks about how when we get sick, the illness affects us physically, but it also affects the stories that we tell about who we are and where we're going in our lives. Arthur Frank uses this metaphor of the shipwreck. We're like ships sailing along, and then suddenly this storm hits us, and the storm is some kind of illness that we can't fully make sense of. And the illness may cause the ship to capsize, it's set off track. And that's our story. The way that we think about where we're going in our lives changes. We can't do the same things that we used to be able to do. You know, we can't lift the same amount that we used to be, or do the same activities, or we can't have the energy that we used to have to complete the tasks that we needed to do before. Mm-hmm. So that is what Frank calls narrative wreckage. Our stories, our narratives are suddenly wrecked by illness, and we need to take a moment to retell our stories. So for Frank, storytelling repairs broken narratives. And he says that there is a bunch of different kinds of narratives. So I can go through these all, but I was actually curious whether or not you had done any interviews before where you get into illness narratives on your podcast.
No, I have not.
Okay. So this is relatively new, but I'm guessing you've heard lots of illness narratives. And as part of your show, if people tell the story of their illness, that's an illness narrative.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Between the classes I teach, between just working with people one-on-one, yeah, it's definitely something. And working with people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it's a fascinating thing to see how how we process things differently. And you're right. And how those stories change over time for people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, and that's one thing that Frank really emphasizes, that every story is different. It does change over time as people come to terms with what's happening to them, and as new things happen to them that they have to come to terms with. And he says that there are these three different main narrative types, but they kind of all blend together at different points in one's illness experience. So let me do my professorial lecture thing and talk about these narratives. So the first narrative that Frank goes through is what he calls the restitution narrative. And he says when most people get sick, this is the story that they tell themselves, because oftentimes when we get sick, if it's something just like a cold, if it's a minor injury, we're going to recover from that injury. And so when that happens, when we know that we're going to recover, we don't need to tell a whole new story about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can use the same old story. There may be the shipwreck is just a temporary slowing of the narrative that we already have. And under the restitution narrative, people tend to, it's about kind of the relationship that people have with physicians. Frank doesn't really get into non-traditional healers, non-traditional medical personnel, but he especially emphasizes the interaction that people have with physicians.
Okay.
And so he says that the restitution narrative is characterized by this sort of submitting to the authority of the physician. If the physician says you need to take antibiotics for 10 days, people go and take antibiotics for 10 days because they want to return to their normal state. They want to get back to their normal state of health. And so when somebody gets sick, they discipline their bodies, they do the things that they need to do to get better, and then they move on with their lives. And the body is kind of seen as a separate entity. Sickness is something that happens to the body. We dissociate from our bodies when we tell restitution narratives. The mind is something that has to control the body. The physician is the authority over the body. And the body is sort of becomes our enemy in this restitution narrative. And There are these roles that we have to play when we get sick. The sick role is something that we can get away with because people get sick all the time, and we know that they're allowed to miss work. As long as they act sick enough, it's okay. And so Frank says that this is just what typically happens when people get sick. The problem is when somebody gets sick and they don't get better and they continue to tell the restitution narrative, and they may be struggling for years to return to their normal state. It's a problem because they're dissociated from their bodies. They're still in this authoritative relationship with their physicians, and they're kind of compromised from telling a new story about themselves. So for Frank, it's important to kind of get beyond this restitution narrative. At a certain point, one has to just recognize, well, my life is going to go on, but it's not going to go on in the way that it used to. It's going to go on in a new way. He says that people need new stories in part because, you know, when you get sick, you have to explain what's happening. People call. They want to know why you're not at work. They want to know what's going on, why you're not feeling well. And so people are forced to tell new stories. So oftentimes the story is the restitution narrative. But Frank says that sometimes, especially in the case of a chronic illness or when a person can't get a decisive diagnosis, when there are symptoms that are happening, when they're suffering, but there's no clear path to healing, where there's no return to the normal state of health, that life becomes chaos and that it's very hard to actually tell the story about one's illness. And he calls this the chaos narrative. The plot of this narrative is that we imagine that our life never gets better. We're kind of in this state of confusion about what's going on with our bodies. And there may be a sense of futility toward medical treatment. Things just aren't working. You go to the doctor, they prescribe things, it doesn't help. There are all kinds of side effects. Nothing seems to really work. Frank says that in this chaos narrative state, we may dissociate from our bodies, the body loses desire, we lose our sense of agency. And the stories that people tell may be chaotic. People may be living day to day, and it's hard to think about the future. It's hard to think about where we're going. And sometimes these stories can't really be told in words. So this is the chaos narrative. And I think a lot of people get trapped in this chaos narrative. So I don't know if do these narrative forms sound familiar to the kinds of stories that you've heard on your show before?
Yes. Well, yeah. And not by title, but certainly by experience. You know, I think it's very interesting because I can recognize everything that you're saying in particular stories. You know, like you say, the feeling of getting a cold going back or having something go on that is very chronic. And I don't know if this fully fits into the first restorative narrative, but when somebody sort of just, I think it does, in the whole not, it kind of disassociating with their body, they're not really recognizing that all of this sort of chaos is going on inside them. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, and they're living life as if normal and not recognizing that there's something that maybe they don't know how to manage, or maybe that they do know how to manage, but haven't really wrapped their head around yet and accepted. And yeah, I see the chaos. I myself have dealt with kind of like a fibromyalgia type thing that I don't know how to define because there's no real answer for it. And it is that feeling of chaos because you just don't know where to go with your own body, right? You don't know where you're going to be. You want to think positively forward. And I think that's what's gotten me through. I mean, I'm in better condition than I was when I was in my 20s. Uh-huh. Because I have kind of tried to grab onto the things that worked. I've been, you know, had people point me directions, which is part of the reason I do the podcast. It's the people who have said, hey, have you tried this? It's the doctors who have released me from their care and said, no, go forth and search because I don't have anything to offer you. And God bless them. Everyone. Yeah,
that's good that they recognize that.
And yes. And I don't
their own limits and sent you off someplace else.
Exactly. And I don't think they would do that today or they'd be fired. I mean, I know cases of people, and I tend to find the people who are sort of in these outlying, not defined areas. You know, a person that I know who basically the doctor said, you know, well, I'm sorry, I'm basically sending you home to get your affairs in order because I don't have anything and you're kind of dying. And then shut the door and said, okay, I'm going to tell you something that you cannot tell anybody that I told you, but you need to go to this particular place because there are people that can help you and I can't, you know?
Yeah.
And I praise any physician who is able and willing to stick their neck out far enough to sort of do that, because it saved my friend's life for sure. And I've known multiple people who have had, you know, situations like that, who I don't think would be here today had they followed the physician's orders as they were supposed to give them. Mm-hmm. And I think for myself, I think if I had, I'd be sitting somewhere on, you know, antidepressants staring at the wall because my focus would be so bad. So I am grateful. And again, that's why I'm doing what I do, because I don't want anybody else to have to live that life that I could see for myself coming to fruition. But it's the not understanding. It's not that I want to be, you know, for myself, it's not that I want to be diagnosed. All I want is what is this? What am I dealing with? How do I manage it best? I just want an answer. And then you talk to people and sometimes you feel like a spiritual failure because you haven't found the peace in yourself. That is the thing that would, if only you would release this, you would be fine. Mm-hmm. So it's a very fascinating thing. So everything you're saying to me resonates either in my own experience or, like I say, the people that I talk to who are in similar boats of just not quite sure where to turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That definitely sounds like elements of what Frank describes as the chaos narrative. Mm-hmm. He also says that when people get sick, sometimes it has other consequences. They may lose their jobs, or they may lose their partners, or they may lose their homes in certain circumstances, and that intensifies the chaos of experiencing an illness that is difficult to define and hard to get treatment for, hard to get relief from suffering. So this whole podcast that you've done and this the path that you're on is what Frank would call a quest narrative. This is a kind of resolution of ongoing chaos, a recognition that restitution is maybe not going to happen, that one is going to have to live with contingencies in one's life, that there are going to be new symptoms that are hard to address, that every day could bring unexpected changes. For me, I've had chronic back pain for 20 years, and sometimes I can't explain it, but it'll be fine for a year or 2 years. And then I'll wake up one morning and I'll have chronic pain. And for months, it affects my walking. It affects what I can lift. It affects all kinds of things, mm-hmm. My energy levels. So I've kind of come to just recognize that could happen at any time. And I need to move forward and do as much as I can do with the pain that I'm experiencing. And I think a lot of people have reached this quest stage of their storytelling. For Frank, he kind of holds it up as a kind of mission. And he says that people have a duty to tell the stories of their illness. He also says that they have a duty to tell the good story. And for Frank, the good story is the story that doesn't withhold details about the really unpleasant aspects of everyday suffering. It doesn't withhold details about the level of pain that people is in, or doesn't withhold details about something that might not be that nice to talk about. And sharing those details, he says, really helps prepare other people for when they encounter their own illness experiences, because he says most of us are going to be chronically ill at some phase in our lives. Some of us, it won't be until the end of our lives. But he says that we're all wounded storytellers, and we've all faced some kind of wound. We've all had to reshape our stories. And so let's have a better sense of how to retell our stories in a way that helps us to live our lives in the way that we can, following something like a major illness experience. So he gets all into the ethics of this quest narrative. The qu- quest is kind of like when a person recognizes they're not going to get better, then they have to figure out, okay, how am I now going to live my life with this illness? What am I going to do? Mm-hmm. He says that there are a few different kinds of ethics. One is an ethic of recollection, which has to be talking about what's happened in the past, which might be past stories of something that was painful that happened. It might be not just painful having to do with physical pain, but it could be painful interactions one had with a doctor who didn't believe one's story and coming to terms with that painful experience. Mm. And he also says that there's this ethic of solidarity and commitment. That is an ethic of talking about the illness with other people who share that illness experience, so that people aren't so alone, so that there are other people that one can identify with, hear their stories, realize that, you know, my pain is other people's pain is many thousands or millions of other people's pain. And maybe there are things other people have done that can relate to my own illness experience. So I feel kind of like maybe that's part of the podcast project that you're doing.
You know, because sometimes it's a mindset, like I'm listening to you and I'm thinking of how incredibly beneficial it can be to be in a space where you have shared your pain or with somebody else who has shared theirs and you can resonate with it, or you just purely understand them on a whole new level, right? And it's a gift. It's an honor to be in those spaces sometimes. Many times, really, when somebody is able to share. And then, you know, and then I think of people who, and I don't know where this fits into all of this. I'm just thinking of different ways people go about and where they're at in their journey, where there's some people who hold on to their illness as their identifier,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's the thing that they gain empathy or sympathy from and attention for. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a process in, you know, in people's journey sometimes. I don't know that it is in everybody's, and I don't even know that it's conscious. I think sometimes it's the wanting to be understood, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that in my personal opinion and experience, sometimes I see people carry that to the detriment of their helping themselves grab onto the things that could even help them feel better on a basic level. You know, there's the building that wall and not letting anything in versus when you are on that quest and it is about bringing those things in. You're right. I think you're right that it is why I'm doing this. It is on my own quest. Mm-hmm. It is also on helping people on their quest, because I know how lonely that journey can be, you know, having something when you're in your young 20s and you feel like all the time somebody has beaten you up. Like you just constantly feel like you've been physically beaten. And people say, well, you look fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
No.
Invisible illnesses are often the most challenging because they are delegitimized. Mm-hmm. And unrecognized. And so it can be really isolating and it can make people feel like they're all alone. So,
yeah.
So that's all the more important reason to have this this podcast and other podcasts. There are many other podcasts out there. And I think it's because of all these suppressed experiences that people have had that now are much easier to share with a wider audience and create a really different kind of community around crafting quest narratives, I guess, is probably how Arthur Frank would say it.
Right, right. Because many are looking, they're looking to get to the wellness narrative.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's the ultimate goal. But if you aren't able to share and learn from other people and find that either solution, but sometimes just purely the comfort of knowing somebody else is in the world and they get you,
mm-hmm,
it's big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think it can also be empowering for people to have these shared stories and experiences and then bring that knowledge and understanding back to their relationships with physicians later on. That's important as well. So they're not just a kind of docile recipient of medical knowledge, but they're active in possessing their own knowledge and maybe even using it to inform physicians about what they've learned. The story that you told before was so interesting about the physician who closed the door, and I think this was more than one story, so that they could, you know, reveal their real wisdom, which
yes.
is that they're actually not supposed to, or they're not allowed to tell, I think really shows how constrained physicians can be by the rules that govern who they are and what they can do, even against their own best practices and best knowledge. So it really shows that there are some compromises in the system that need to be recognized. Maybe it's important to invite your physician out to coffee so they can tell you these things outside of their office, where they won't be held accountable for malpractice, I guess.
Right. No, I know. I've always said that. I'm like, you need to have friends as doctors as friends. And that's not to put the doctors in this constant place of being doctors. It's to have real conversations, you know, because I think that it's like when you find out that a doctor is saying one thing in their office because they're locked into that, what they can tell, but then you find out they do something very different at home. You know, and I think, again, that's why naturopaths and things like that are so valuable, because you get to know the person and they share real life stuff and what they do and why. And they're not telling you to go live in this particular lifestyle, but then they do something, you know, very different. And I've heard multiple stories of people who have known doctors who are like, oh my gosh, they tell their patients this, but they live this, and when they get asked about it, they're like, I can't say that at work. I can't tell people that I do that. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this system of not being able to be free to give your patients the best that they possibly can get. And I think I think people are honestly very damaged by that daily.
Well, maybe there needs to be a Physician's Confessions podcast.
I love it!
Where they're totally anonymous, you can mask their voice, and they can just call up and say all the things that they do at home that are different from what they actually prescribe in person. How do they treat their own family members?
Yes. Yeah. Oh gosh. I was just talking about this to somebody who said, yeah, he's got a relative that's a physician. And he said, you know, when he talked to us, it's one thing. And the person who I was with had said to his family member, would you tell your patients that? He's like, oh no, I can't tell my patients that. That's not how, you know, and some of it was because of a time thing. You know, I don't have enough time to really educate them to do the right thing, or it's what I need to do. And I always encourage people, you know, go listen to physicians talk and then ask them questions, because especially when they're doing a presentation where they're not necessarily tied to who they work for or something, and asking them, would you do X? Do you do this? You know, I know I heard a story of a physician doing a presentation on, I believe it was aspartame. And the doctor was saying, it's really not really conclusive if it's good or bad. And we have data both ways. And then somebody finally asked, do you eat it? And she was like, oh, no, never, don't touch the stuff. Like, okay, there's the answer I want right there.
Yeah, well, those are good questions to ask. So I'm actually curious, you do interview physicians as part of your podcast. What's the kind of feedback that you've gotten from physicians about the growth of maybe non-traditional biomedical treatments like naturopathy, or alternate medical treatments like naturopathy, acupuncture? Have you found physicians to be increasingly accepting of those treatments, or even making referrals for those treatments?
So the people that I have interviewed are typically pretty open to that stuff, which is why they're open to talking to me. I don't seek out a lot of doctors unless I know them through somebody else, or know them myself. So I haven't, you know, talked to a lot of folks, and I've had a few people that I have asked who haven't responded, and I don't know what that's about. And it's interesting because I feel like, and just talking to people in general, I feel like there are the physicians who are way more open. I mean, I have a friend of mine that was going to have surgery, and the doctor, the surgeon said, go have some acupuncture before surgery. And it ended up actually not requiring, she didn't need surgery afterwards, which is amazing. And then I hear the exact opposite of people who just won't even, and some people, they won't even address it. They've asked their doctor, what about these other things? And it's almost like they get a wall. So I'm always fascinated if that wall means I want to talk to you about this and tell you to go do it, but I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which I know I've heard some doctors say that they absolutely believe that there are so many great things that they could turn their patients onto, but they're not allowed to due to where they work. So I think it's a weird like division. And I think it's an interesting thing, you know, when we're looking for a doctor. And I think this is getting increasingly harder too. When I'm looking for a doctor in the allopathic system, I ask questions.
Yeah.
And what I have gotten lately is no answers.
Oh, interesting.
I have, you know, told them this is how I want the doc, you know, this is, I want the doctor to be open to this. And at least in some of the clinics that I've called, they literally have just said, well, this person has the next appointment available. Do you want them? It's like, no, that's not what I asked.
Yeah.
You know, and I, there's a book out there that I by a physician about how to find a physician. And he gives great, great advice. It's just all advice that I've never been able to figure out how to utilize.
Hey, you, what's the advice? I'm curious.
How it is to, it is things like interview the physician. Ask those questions when you call. Try to talk to the doctor before you see them. Get them outside the office. All of those things that I've never found a way to actually do.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who said, I would like to talk to my physician before I actually have to see and pay them. Again, not so true with the natural medicine, right? Yeah, I can't remember, but there was a lot of, you know, really basically saying your doctor needs to have a personal relationship with you. They need to care about who you are. They need to be somebody who's going to be a little more open to taking your phone call, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a problem, my experience with that situation is the person at the end of the phone says, well, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to come into an appointment. I don't care how benign this question is. It's like, but I have to take a whole day. Half a day off of my life to do that.
Right.
And when I've been in jobs, well, I have to take a half day off work. Well, if you want your question answered, that's just what you have to do.
So it
feels like all the good advice is, I don't know where these doctors are. I don't know if I'm looking in the wrong system or if the system is just, you know, it's that messed up, which is maybe the case. I don't know. But yeah, so How do we, I mean, it's a question of how do we navigate the system when we are trying to navigate our illness and our illness narratives, and to, when we do find those doctors, like you said, you found a doctor that's very good about taking time. They're busy. I think they're still, those are the people we need to hang on to and let them know we value everything they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think it's worth waiting. And in part because I have also had the experience of having a doctor who I had seen for 10 years who had no idea who I was every time I would visit.
Ooh.
And it was one of those situations where I would get in for 7 minutes or 5 minutes and that would be it. And I felt like, well, maybe I have some other things to say, or maybe this process actually needs some time to work itself out so I can talk about other things that are going on that don't neatly fit into the particular symptom that I'm having on a given day.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really glad. And I also found somebody who's younger than me, which I feel like is important because I've had doctors who were much older than me, and then also, my family has had doctors who are older, and then they retire, and then you have to start all over again. So I'm hoping that, you know, this doctor is going to be around when I get older, and I need them to be around and still practicing.
Right. Well, and your 7-minute statement too, you know, the other thing that's coming with that is when people are looking to go to the doctor, get some help, they also want to be heard. And nowadays the doctors are looking at the computer screens that they're not even looking at you. So you could pass them in the hall 5 minutes later and they might not even recognize you you know, they have had to focus on the screen and it takes away from any connection that you can have. They can't read your body language. They can't read they're hardly hearing the pain of your voice. If your voice tone has something to tell sometimes because they're trying to figure out how to restructure the sentence to put it into their notes.
Yeah. Well, maybe that should be part of their note taking. Maybe it is, you know, maybe using all of the senses is increasingly important to some physicians, at least.
Right.
And it should be, maybe it could be built into those note-taking systems. This is why we need to have medical anthropologists working for healthcare organizations, I think.
Yes. Yeah, well, right. And you know, and I think it speaks right back to why the narratives are so important and powerful for people is because they get, you know, when you're talking to somebody, whether it's over the phone or in person, even you're still, I feel like, more heard sometimes than you are by your doctor.
Yeah.
At times. And that isn't to say that there aren't doctors who are really trying to work with the system and they're really trying to still pay attention. You know, I know that they're trying to do that, but it's a tall order. But it brings us back to why those narratives are important and why we desire to talk to other people and how nowadays, you know, if we're going to try to fit in the system, talking to somebody else helps us sometimes process through our stuff and hone in on our own narrative. So when we get to the doctor, we can be more quick and concise and perhaps more even bold in the way we present ourselves to the doctor or have those things thought out and written down on a list that maybe forces the doctor to pay attention. I know that it doesn't always work. I've had people who have walked in with great data for their doctor and their doctor says, I don't need that. You know, so... And that's just very extremely dismissive as well.
Yeah, incredibly dismissive, disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine it would be hard to go forward with a particular doctor who discounts any self-knowledge that's been generated. I mean, a person who lives with their illness experience all the time is going to be much more of an expert about what's happening and the specificity of the symptoms than a physician who's staring at a computer screen. That's not to say that physicians, because they see so many patients, they can sometimes very quickly identify patterns and make diagnoses, and that's incredibly valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But in cases that they can't, maybe it is important to take into account the knowledge that's been accumulated by patients and establish a different kind of relationship with them. I wanted to just read this quote from Arthur Frank from The Wounded Storyteller. He talks about storytelling and why people tell stories. He says that storytelling is for an other just as much as it is for oneself. And I really like that, you know, we tell stories for ourselves. He calls them self stories. They help us figure out who we are and what's going on with us, but they're also for other people.
Mm-hmm.
He says that in the reciprocity that is storytelling, the teller offers herself as a guide to the other's self-formation. The other's receipt of that guidance not only recognizes but values the teller. The moral genius of storytelling is that each teller and listener enters the space of the story for the other. I really like that because storytelling and telling illness narratives has to do with forming a relationship with a person who is the listener. And the process of storytelling is valuable for both parties, not just the listener who's gaining the wisdom of the storyteller's illness experience, but the storyteller gets to craft their own story. There's an oral historian I really like. He talks about how oral stories rescue the teller from oblivion. You know, they capture a part of us after we're gone. That story will still be remembered and maybe even retold by other people. So storytelling is important. Sometimes my students feel like they're burdening they're narrators, and they go out to do these long illness narrative interviews or oral history interviews. They feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to take up so much of this person's time. But most of the time, people want to tell their stories. Telling stories is what makes them alive. It's what makes the life meaningful, valuable. It rescues them from oblivion. I want to be rescued from oblivion, you know.
Right.
It's like a useful thing to happen. And almost every time they do these projects, they get amazing stories. People really open up and share, and they share important details about their lives, their illness experiences, that, you know, it gets students out of who they know and what they think they know about the world. Yeah. And it's always one of the most powerful parts of the whole quarter is when we listen to these stories.
I bet. I mean, I can imagine that. And I'm betting there are some people that they ask for their stories and the person would say, I'm burdening you with my story. But since there is a purpose and it's a class project, yes. that you have a purpose to listen. Mm-hmm. And to have somebody hear that and to get to know, I mean, when you sit down with somebody, and I've had the privilege of being in people's lives who have gone through some pretty severe stuff, and being able to hear that and be with them on their journey is an amazing thing, because you're right. I agree with you 100%. You learn a lot about the world. You learn a lot about not only how that person thinks, but options of ways to think. We have such a weird relationship with death in our culture, right? Like, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to acknowledge it. And then when somebody is sick, we really don't want to acknowledge it. I knew somebody who was a retired pastor and talking to somebody in hospice. And he would say, when this friend of mine would come, the retired pastor, he said one time, he says, I'm so glad you're here, because I just want to talk about my end of life and death. And I can't, because my kids and my grandkids, oh, you're going to be okay. He's like, I'm in a hospice. I'm not going to be okay. You know, and I want to acknowledge that and share that. But people, we fear that. We don't know how to deal with it. And even though sickness doesn't necessarily, and illness doesn't necessarily equal death, there sometimes is that you're facing that discussion, or you're facing those thoughts. You know, I think in times when I have had really bad situations where you are thinking about death, because you're thinking about, what is the value of life? If this is my life, if this is what it's going to be, is this worth it, right? I'm thinking sometimes having those conversations when they're shared in those illness narratives, and when you can be really, really just raw with somebody about how you feel, and you trust them enough to share that with them. It's an amazing thing to have somebody really hear you and really get you. You know, that is an amazing thing to be able to be on both ends of, I think. And I imagine the students get to experience that and learn so much about, you know, a family member that, you know, especially if they can get into those deep thoughts of what they're really thinking and what goes on inside their daily life and their mind. Those are things we don't always get to share, or they get dismissed, or if we share them, we feel sort of wrong sometimes for sharing them.
Yeah. There's an expectation that we're going to comfort the person who's listening to our stories and reassure them that we're really okay and we'll make it through it. Frank says that's why the restitution narrative is so prevalent, because there's an expectation that we're not going to talk about the really hard things in life, that we're not going to talk about what's unpleasant. I think especially here in the United States, in this culture or set of cultures, that we don't like to talk about what's really unpleasant. We don't like to talk about death either. We don't like to think about it. We don't like to prepare for it maybe in the way that we need to. And that keeps us returning to restitution and putting us in situations that might not be the best for our end of life. You know, we might have a better end of life if we didn't have to be polite about what's happening to us.
Yes. Yes. I've been a part of doing death cafes for the last few months. And it is one of those things that I think those discussions can bring us ideas of we get the idea of, how do we want to die? You know, what do we want our own death to look like, and have permission to talk about it and have it be fun. I was with my mother-in-law during the process of planning her funeral, and we had so many laughs, and we had, you know, it brought you closer to understanding the person she was and what was important to her. And it was a gift to be able to do that, to share the laughs and the joy and the silliness around making jokes about death and dying. And to have the freedom to do that lightens it up. And I think it allows people to actually have a much, like you're saying, a much better experience that is very real. And we don't have to be so somber and know that this is a part of life, and it's difficult and it's sad, but it doesn't have to be so serious or put in a box of how it needs to look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, that's really exciting work. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing to think that death doesn't have to be such a heavy experience that's silencing and enclosed and isolating, and that it can be something that has some joy to thinking about, you know, what does it mean to live one's life in a different way with the recognition that one is dying or one is going to have to face death at some point in the future. I mean, maybe Arthur Frank will write The Dying Storyteller next. I know he's written several other books, and I'm realizing that I need to read them. Probably they're more recent, but this is the one I keep coming back to for now. So we'll see. Yeah.
Interesting. I think and part of the mission of the Death Cafe is about us thinking about how do we live our life better each day with that knowledge, you know? We've definitely talked about the purpose and the benefit of telling our stories, because I think there is a huge one. And I also can imagine that there are people who listen to the idea and say, well, this telling your illness narrative it's negative. You're bringing discomfort, or you're bringing negativity into the world simply by talking. There's a book that I always forget the name of for when I try to think about it. She basically talks about the sort of positive attitude movement and how much damage that has done.
Yeah.
And how she had breast cancer and she got really tired of people. It wasn't her experience, but she got tired of trying to be put into that box of breast cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me. And she's like, no, this sucked. This really sucked. And I think that honestly, some of the sharing of the illness narratives can truly help people be positive.
Yeah, that's what I think. I wouldn't make that distinction. Yeah, I think illness narratives are positive. The quest narrative, even though it may reveal details about experiences of suffering that people don't want to hear, I think it's really positive. I guess you mentioned breast cancer, so I'm thinking about another book, which actually Arthur Frank discusses extensively in The Wounded Storyteller, and that's Audre Lorde's book, The Cancer Journals. And this is a book that Audre Lorde wrote in the late 1970s, early 80s, after an extended experience with breast cancer. And Audre Lorde did end up dying from cancer in the early 1990s. But this book is really about her writing about the experience as she was going through it, and then reading those writings, coming to terms with what happened and developing a voice. And she basically says that, you know, our silence will get us nowhere. We need to talk about these things. We need to understand what place they have in our life and not to accept the stigma that might be placed on our bodies because of our illness experiences. We need to, basically empower ourselves through seizing our own stories. Really, the quest narrative, I think for Frank, comes out of Audre Lorde's telling of her cancer experience. I can't imagine how that's not a positive story, how that wouldn't provide people with strength who are going through challenging times. Mm-hmm. To have a positive story that silences suffering is not helpful to anyone, I think. It's merely something that allows us to get by with not thinking about it. Mm-hmm. It's something that is polite and doesn't disturb us to tell a positive story. But I think we need to be disturbed, and we need to learn how to live with complex situations that don't always make sense and that aren't always pleasant, because that's what life is. It means facing these things sometimes head on, and that's how we grow. So,
well, as a person, as a group, as a society, if we never talk about the challenges, we don't ever get a chance to change, or, you know, the big picture.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to say that one of the motivations for doing these oral histories and the illness narrative projects is because just talking and telling one story and listening is an art form that has been increasingly disappeared throughout the world. And it's being replaced by other kinds of communication that I think don't really capture the complex experience of being a human being, or trying to be a human being. I don't think anybody does it very successfully. So,
tell me if there's anything else, you know, that we can think about when it comes to these narratives. How can we use them for good in furthering our own well-being, our people around us well-being, and anything that you haven't shared about the narratives yet that you need to or want to?
Well, I do a lot of work on archive as part of my research. I do ethnographic research, oral history work, which this isn't, the illness narratives fit into. And then I do archival research. And I guess I'm interested in the role of the curator. And I see you as kind of taking up that role. You're recording these interviews, you're posting them online, you're creating this archive, you're curating the stories, in that you edit them to a certain extent. And I think the curator role is increasingly important. Maybe it's problematic, but with the amount of information that exists in the world that we're inundated with, the burying of documents that can connect with us in some important way, I think needs curators to uncover those things, to feature them, to share them with us, to give us a nudge to say, just pay attention to this for a minute and see where it leads you. So I guess I like to think that I like to hope that my students will take this curatorial role at some point. And in the social sciences, we collect lots of data and it gets buried someplace and people don't look at it. But to know what's really important and how to feature it and how to share it beyond just a Facebook post, I think is something that I hope that they do. So, and I'm glad that you're sort of doing that process on this show.
Oh, well, thank you. I love science and studies and hard data, but I also believe there is a lot to be said in the sort of narrative anecdotal. I, again, being a physical outlier for many things, I have my experience very much denied because, well, that's not what the science says. So clearly your body isn't doing that right now. And I think that it's why people need to have their stories both shared, listened to. Yeah, because that data is just as important.
Yeah, I guess I would maybe resist the idea that it's anecdotal evidence. I would call it an in-depth case study is what I would call it, maybe, just so we can give some validity to people's stories and their life experiences that cannot be captured by any kind of quantitative measure. I think that there are stories that people tell that are so idiosyncratic that they wouldn't emerge in a pattern of some kind of more extensive social science deductive research project. So these stories are themselves completely valid in some ways as a way of understanding the human experience.
Right. I like that. I agree. And I think the word anecdotal has actually just gotten to be a negative word. That's a dismissive word that we hear often. Well, that's just anecdotal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For that person, it might be. Yeah, it's life. So thank you. This has been so much fun. Mm-hmm. I I do you mind if I put your like webpage up for your college?
Oh, totally. Put my webpage up.
Okay.
Yes, college.
Okay.
I think that would be great. Yeah, okay. We we're a really unique school. We can do great things for a lot of different students who might not have their needs met by, traditional university or college, where they're taking different classes. And also, we don't have grades. I don't know if that helps at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, sure.
That's
sure,
awesome.
Put up our website.
Well, I certainly feel like had I listened to your information about your college before I went to college, I would have been like, okay, so how do I move there?
Yeah. Send all your kids to the Evergreen State College. We'll take good care of them. We promise.
We need different learning experiences. And like you say, you're seeing so much success. And I know, people who have had family members that go to school who are a little differently traditional, different mm-hmm. than the tradition. And some of them cost a lot of money. And I think that that's messed up. I think that to have learning patterns that are not typical be a privilege again. It's not okay. It's what people need. We know that our system is outdated, and so why do we continue to live in a system and thinking this is the way to go? So these new ways of immersing students into information and helping them learn how to do life, which is what we all need to figure out how to do, are so important. And when they're succeeding, we need to take note and make that a reality.
Yeah, well put. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This was great.
This was great. And, I think one of my favorite quotes was the "we need to be disturbed" quote. I could do a whole podcast hour long on that exact concept, I think. I love that for the way he speaks of it and many other tentacles that sort of drift off of that as well. In the show notes, I will share the link to Evergreen College, as well as to Eric's page, if you want to learn a little bit more about him as well. And in the show notes, I'll include a link to the book he mentions too. It is an interesting thing as I think about the work that the podcast does, as I talk to practitioners and we dive a little deeper sometimes into looking at why are they doing what they're doing? How has their, illness narrative, whatever type it is, shaped a course that they have taken in their life and the story that they tell about their history as well as their current and then going forward in their future. So it's just a very interesting way to frame things and to think about it and to think about that story that we leave behind or process through in our own mind. Coming up on future podcasts, we have some great health advice and insight from Dr. John Herbert. We're going to talk about restorative justice, food allergies, some more about essential oils and some really cool things that are being done with them. So keep an eye out for what we've got going on. Thank you so much for listening. Take good care. We'll see you next week. And until then, please continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle. Cheers.